Thank you so much. So thank you to the library. Thank you to all of you for being here today. My name is Emmeline Weiner, and as you said, I'm a board member of the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice and one of the many people who have worked on the One Human Family campaign. Thank you again, yes, for joining us, taking a Wednesday night to be here at the library in recognition of the fact that we are all one human family. We are so fortunate to have these opportunities for dialogue and idea sharing, and we plan to take full advantage of the collective knowledge and wisdom in the room this evening. The One Human Family campaign arose out of a need to show explicit support to a specific segment of our population who had come under scrutiny and unfair suspicion, to demonstrate that the value of good neighborliness and kindness trumps those suspicions. That was accidental. I apologize. But when one member of our family is treated unfairly, we all have to step forward and defend them. And while media and political platforms have allowed anti-Islamic rhetoric to take center stage, we in the Ann Arbor area created our own stage. And we want to make it clear that we appreciate American Muslims and we welcome refugees and immigrants of all kinds.
Can you slow down a bit so we can hear you?
Yes, I apologize. So this message of one human family has been accepted and broadcast by our community with overwhelming support. You've seen the banners in front of houses of worship. You've seen the signs on lawns. Hopefully you've seen stickers and buttons and posts on Facebook. This effort has been a joint campaign by the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice and the Interfaith Roundtable of Washtenaw County. And it has been such a success. We are so proud of how Ann Arbor area residents have really adopted it and made it their own. Ann Arbor City Council even jumped on board and has officially declared Ann Arbor to be a welcoming city. But largely, the One Human Family campaign has been an awareness campaign, encouraging people to continue to treat one another fairly and compassionately. But tonight, we want to hear a little bit more about how to be effective and informed allies and how we can put some of this goodwill and turn it into good works. So a little bit of housekeeping before I introduce our panelists. I'm going to start to send around sign-in sheets. We would like to get your information so that we can continue to share these opportunities to declare ourselves one human family. Also, if you would like more information about the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice or the Interfaith Roundtable, there are tables in the back, and when we are done tonight, I encourage you to stop by. Also, all of our panelists are happy to speak to you after we're done with the questions section. So if you'd like to come forward, please introduce yourselves to them and ask whatever questions that you have. We also have One Human Family lawn signs still available. Hopefully you all got a sticker also on your seat. The lawn signs we offer free with goodwill for you showing up tonight. We've historically been asking for a donation of $5 to $10, and if you would still like to donate, I will not chase you out of town. So you can talk to myself or Chuck Warpowski, who is in the back there waving, if you'd like to make a donation and take a sign. Or Deb Krause also is here. You can. Oh, you're waving at Chuck. Gotcha. Yep. With that said, let me quickly introduce our panelists. Our first speaker will be Mostab Amour. He's an intern at the Interfaith Council of Peace and Justice. He's going to give a little presentation. And then we will put up the screen and have our panelists come and sit forward. So for right now, they'll just sort of wave to you. Laura Sanders is with the Washtenaw Interfaith Coalition on Immigrants' Rights. Shrina Ida is with Jewish Family Services. Miriam Ashraf has been host to unaccompanied minors who have come to the United States as refugees. She's going to speak. And Sowa Malad, who's a recent refugee from Afghanistan. Rita Todoran is from Washtenaw Refugee Welcome, and she will be speaking. And then we will also have time to take your questions and direct them towards whatever panelist is most prepared to answer them. So with that said, Mostab, will you please come forward?
Thank you, Emmeline. I would like to thank everyone for showing up with us today tonight. I'll be speaking about my experience being an immigrant in the U.S., an important event that impacted my goals and what I wanted to do in the future, and walk you through that. The year 2001 marked a sad event, which not only impacted the United States, but also many other countries around the world. I was 10 years old in Morocco when the 9/11 terrorist attack happened. We were all shocked and saddened by what happened to this nation. We spoke of it then, and we still do now. This event impacted many things on many levels, including an increase in negative stereotyping of Arabs and Muslims. My friends and family members all suffer from an increase in stereotyping and racial profiling worldwide, including within my own country, Morocco, and additional difficulties traveling abroad. The increase of Islamophobia has made profiling an everyday occurrence for Muslims everywhere. Simple things, such as having a beard or even having a different name, have become a cause for concern. I remember one time when I was 20 years old, during my first travel abroad, I was questioned about my name at an airport. Is your name Musab, as in Musab al-Zarqawi, who was a leader of a terrorist group then? That was not just a simple question. Being somehow compared or put in the spotlight of a terrorist leader is something enormous. I was speechless. I never thought I would be questioned for my name or compared to a personality of a terrorist based on that. I was afraid what the next question would be or what was gonna happen next. When I was a child, I was taught that people being different is a great thing. I knew that is a human nature for people to stereotype and that we all have some bias. But when the tragic event of 9/11 happened, the kind of stereotyping I witnessed changed drastically. Profiling became something I had to be very afraid of. Living through that moment, I decided to do something to have a positive impact. When I was old enough, I started volunteering with international organizations that connected people and cultures, including ISEC, the Rotary, and the United Nations Association. I decided to pursue my studies in the US, meet people, and prove in action, not only words, how not all Muslims and Arabs are terrorists. At the age of 20, I applied for my first exchange program in the US. It was an intense process getting to America, both the visa process and being accepted for the program. I did hear it was much easier before the 9/11. When I first came to the US, I met many Americans who had so many questions for me. I was glad to answer them. Many of them had never met or spoken to an Arab or Muslim. I was amazed by the thirst for knowledge and learning many people had. I came back in 2014 as an international student, and last year in December, I graduated from Eastern Michigan University in the field of international affairs. Thank you. I decided to take a year off after graduation to volunteer with an organization that works directly for peace through economic and social justice. I was lucky to find one right here in Ann Arbor, the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice. At this organization, we work on many projects. One human family is one of them, where congregations and individuals are putting banners and signs in their yards to show support for Muslims and all refugees from different backgrounds. I know that putting a sign in your yard can be a much bigger thing than a sign, just like being questioned about your name. It is exposing an ideology of a choice in which a person takes the risk without knowing how people and neighbors could perceive it, mostly in a time of increased level of hate crimes, anti-Islamic and anti-refugee rhetoric. I'm proud of how the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice has made this opportunity for people to come together to support Muslims and refugees. I have talked to family members, friends back home and in other countries about the campaigns and projects this organization does. They are very impressed. I shared with them the One Human Family campaign. They were amazed and very thankful seeing many people here in the U.S. willing to fight for good in a world full of negative actions and in a country where some people promote hate. We can see that the work of the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice does not only have an impact on a local level, but also on the international level. When people from other countries see the work of this organization and many others, it definitely changes and improves the positive feelings towards the U.S. as a whole and gives hope to people and youth that there are still people in the United States of America promoting love, peace, and social justice. Volunteering with the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice is helping shape my future. This organization has taught me to believe in change and that there are many great people out there who are willing to join the efforts of understanding and accepting differences, and that together we will make change. At the end, let me say thank you and may peace be upon you. Thank you.
So now we're going to delve a little bit deeper into a couple of these different issues that the campaign has addressed. And we're going to start by hearing from Laura Sanders, who's with the Washtenaw Interfaith Coalition on Immigrants' Rights. And I'll sort
Thank
of
you.
Wave at you when you're starting to near time.
Yeah, okay. I was just going to say, because I can kind of go on and on. I might have to be pulled off with a hook or something like that. So thank you for inviting me as a representative of the Washtenaw Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights, and thank you for that wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
It was absolutely beautiful. Can everyone hear me? Not sure if this, okay. Let me just introduce our organization for a moment, and then we'll talk a little bit more about kind of the landscape of what we're seeing in terms of increased immigration enforcement in this area post 9/11. The Washtenaw Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights started, we're in our eight and a half, we've been going for 8.5 years. We started in 2008 in March in response to a particularly brutal immigration raid of a Latino, primarily Latino community in a mobile home community that sits in between Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. And there had been a few of us involved in kind of, sanctuary city types of organizing towards sanctuary city and friendly city ordinances. And when this raid occurred, we heard about it. And my spouse happens to be from Mexico, and he's from 17 brothers and sisters, a big, large farming family. And he was here without documents. He was here without papers. He since has become documented, but at the time, he wasn't, and he was very, very connected. He had a lot of friends here, very connected to his immigrant community, and we were friends also with other folks that were working toward some kind of immigrant rights policies. And this raid happened, and it happened on Palm Sunday, the Sunday before Easter, and they basically came in, a lot of Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents assisted by our local police, and it's a very long story, but I'll shorten it and tell you that they took out approximately 21 undocumented workers and left families absolutely broken and devastated. And the one family that we really convened to help, there were little children, there was a grandfather, there was a father that was taken. They were brutal. They busted into the home. They threw people on the floor. Women and children ran to hide in the bathroom. They put a hole in the bathroom, in the door of the bathroom wall, door of the bathroom in this mobile home. They ransacked the entire place. They took the two men. That same day, they went into Wendy's and took out a woman who had been working there for 8 years, and her husband had already been deported, and her three-year-old, who was suffering from epilepsy, was left with a neighbor with absolutely no plan for her. So there were a lot of families and children affected, and one of the people that had been working with us called and said, this is happening. And so there were a number of us that had been involved, a few of us that had been here in Ann Arbor area for a long time. And we called together everybody that we could think of. I'm a therapist in the community. I'm also instructor at U of M. We called Peace and Justice folks. We called churches and synagogues and faith people. We called academics, and we called student groups. And within 12 hours of that first raid, we had convened about 50 people that represented about 35 or 40 different community groups, and we convened in Ypsilanti at the First Congregational United Church of Christ, which is now our kind of fiduciary, our home base, basically. And we had the young woman who was left there with her two children. They had taken her husband and the grandfather, and her children were one and three, and just clinging to her in horror. The one little girl was completely kind of checked out. I mean, just traumatized. And she couldn't speak English. She spoke in Spanish and told her story. And that, you know, to make a long story short, that was the first kind of, that was the crisis that pulled our organization together. From that point, we got involved in trying to help that family, and that's a long story. But the night before Easter, which is just a week later, we held another, what we called an emergency meeting in our community about it, and we also invited any of the Latino undocumented immigrant community that was available and would be brave enough to come, because it was a very, very frightening, shocking kind of event to have happen. And that second meeting, we had well over 100 people. And that was really the inception of our organization. So from that time, one of our first priorities was to set up some kind of urgent response for families that might experience this. And I don't know, I mean, this is, you know, I'm not sure how much everyone knows about Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol, but they are arms of the Department of Homeland Security. And when so we're within 100 miles of a border. We didn't have a Department of Homeland Security, which I'm sure a lot of people understand, until post 9/11, right? And really, they were charged. They're very well-funded. They were charged with erasing, finding and removing terrorists, right? But they ended up really focusing. There's not, given that there's not that many terrorists to remove, they ended up really focusing on the southern border and scapegoating the many undocumented immigrants that have come across our border and come and gone over the years with this kind of transnational migration. We're within 100 miles of a border, so their efforts to deport people are very trumped up, no pun intended, around the border. And they have, still a mandate of 400,000 people they're supposed to deport every year. So there has been massive increased immigration enforcement since 9/11, and it has greatly affected our area because we are within this 100-mile border. It's affected every area, though, in the United States. But so what do we do? Wicker now, after 8 years, we have documented every phone call that we've gotten, which we're pretty proud of, and we're an all-volunteer grassroots organization. So that's kind of hard to do. We have people who carry a phone. They're called urgent responders, and they answer the phone as urgently as they can. And our statistics tell us, and remember, these are kind of tip of the iceberg, because we can only count what the people that actually call us. So there's a lot of people suffering that actually don't call us because they're afraid or because they don't know. But we've taken 570 calls in the last eight years, and we know that half of those calls involve the detainment or deportation of at least one adult. Okay, so oftentimes those are multiple. We know that hundreds of children have lost their primary parents, primarily U.S. citizen children who and children who are undocumented, but have left their who have lost their primary parents, and then thousands of children have lost providing adults. So every time they do this, they really create more and more single parent families. I think part of the strategy is that they think that they detain and deport the male in the household who is the breadwinner and is more comfortable oftentimes in the public arena. And then they hope that the mother will follow with the children back to the, quote, home country. But many of these people have been here for a very long time and are very, very much a fabric, part of the fabric of their communities. Their children are U.S. citizens. They have lives here that they would not be able to have, because most people who come here are really economic. We could consider them economic refugees, right? Escaping poverty, trying to survive. But they don't qualify for refugee status, because you've got to have specific criterion to qualify for refugee status. So we respond to anybody, family's needs. We've done a lot of education in the community, and there's lots of ways to get involved in Wicker. We're having a Wicker Urgent Responder volunteer training next Saturday on October 8th, and we're going to that's about a two-hour training if anybody's interested in finding out more about how to get involved. But we do go out into the community and speak. We do Know Your Rights education with community members so that people really know what their rights are. We get involved in changing policies here in our locally and nationally, like we've gotten some resolutions to support immigrant families passed. And we get involved with our police to try to make sure our police stay out of the out of the business of immigration enforcement. We get involved in campaigns to stop certain people's and families' deportations. And then we're constantly making sure that we involve the undocumented community as much as possible in the center of the organization, so that their voices are what are moving our work. So thank you very much for listening, and that's what we do, and I'm happy to answer more questions later about the general experience of undocumented immigrants here who are facing this kind of increased immigration enforcement. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, now we're going to hear from Shrina Ada, who works with Jewish Family Services, who has a long history in Washtenaw County of resettling refugees.
Thank you. Yep. So Jewish Family Services has been resettling refugees in Washtenaw County for over 20 years. We also have a lot of supportive services, aside from resettlement, that serves our entire community. So I encourage you to look on our website And if somebody needs assistance, we are here to help. So I wanted to provide information about the resettlement process, which starts overseas, to the resettlement process of when refugees come to the United States. I don't know about you, but when I watch the news, I hear a lot of myths. I hear a lot of false information. And I believe knowledge is power, so I'm here to inform you of what the process is actually like, so that when you go into the community, you have the right information to share. So a lot of people ask me, you know, how can refugees come to the United States? So they have to have a well-founded fear of persecution, and there are five protected grounds that they can come on. So religious persecution, political opinion, if they have something different than the majority, that's leading the country, the race, nationality, or membership to a particular social group. The total processing time for when somebody initially applies for refugee status to when they come to the United States can be about 18 months to 4 years. And that's a long period of time, but it kind of depends on their location, as well as what other circumstances they're in. And there's a lot of checks and balances that are involved, which I will outline in a minute. So if, you know, a checks and balance kind of expires, they have to redo it, and then that extends this process. So the screening process is really extensive for refugees. They are subject to one of the highest level of security checks for any category of traveler coming to the United States. And there are actually about 9 checks that they have to go through. So first, a refugee overseas, for example, living in Syria or Iraq, if they are experiencing one of those 5 sort of protected ground categories, they typically flee to another city and they live in that city, or they can actually flee to camps. So when that process happens, they identify themselves to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So I'm going to say UNHCR for short, because that's a really long name. So when they first go, they collect bio information, so their name, address, birth dates, places of birth, fingerprints for everybody in the household. And then what they do is they go through a series of interviews which confirm the refugee status. If applicants are a strong candidate for the resettlement program, then they will proceed to the next level of checks. And actually, less than 1% of the global refugee population actually receives refugee status, which isn't a lot. Once that happens, they are received by a federally funded resettlement support center, so RSC. There are 9 RSCs around the world that will collect more identifying information. They create an applicant file, and then they conduct biographic security checks. So these security checks actually are done by the National Counterterrorism Center, so the intelligence community, the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department. So a lot of checks happening. And the screening, they look for indicators, like if somebody's linked to, if somebody is a security risk, or if they're linked to criminal violations. After that, if all that goes smoothly, then they are processed by the Department of Homeland Security. So they have another interview conducted by DHS. Fingerprints are collected again, and then they re-interview if something doesn't check out. And if something doesn't check out, then that process stops. They don't continue with the resettlement process. If all goes okay, then they again go for fingerprints, which are taken by U.S. governmental employees, and those fingerprints get checked by the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and then Department of Defense. So again, fingerprints are checked. If all that goes well, they will go for medical screenings to test out for any medical issues like tuberculosis, that they don't want individuals with like TB coming to the United States. So they will help individuals get the right medications, to help resolve any medical issues that are going on, and that's for everybody in the family. After that, they receive a cultural orientation where they provide information about what it's like to live in the United States. And then they will be referred to a domestic resettlement location. So there are about 9 resettlement agencies that will receive the case. And how that happens is those 9 resettlement agencies work with affiliates like my office. And they will decide, so if somebody has a family or friend in Washtenaw County, then those 9 agencies would get that case, and then that case would be forwarded to my agency. Another way a family could come is by being a free case. So typically those are special immigrant visa holders, which have worked for our U.S. Army in Afghanistan or Iraq. So if they're a free case, those free cases, wherever they come from, they are allocated to agencies where there's a large population. So we usually do receive large populations of Afghans and Iraqis coming to our agency as free cases. Total affiliates of those 9 agencies, there's about 350 of us, and there are agencies like mine all over the country and within about 180 communities. So my resettlement agency is HIAS, formerly known as Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, but there's also Church World Service, Ethiopian Community Development Council, International Rescue Commission, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, World Relief, U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So those are the 9 resettlement agencies. So once they are designated to an affiliate like mine, IOM, so the International Organization for Migration, will schedule travel, and then refugees will be notified, and they will come to the U.S. For resettlement. So what that process looks like is, as a resettlement agency, we get notified roughly about 2 weeks to a month ahead of time. Sometimes we only have 1 week if the case has to leave their country very quickly. And at that point, we are talking with if they have family or friends in the area, and if they don't, we are planning for this case to arrive. So we arrange everything from housing to transportation from to the airport and wherever they need to go after, whether they're living in an apartment or with their family. We arrange for, we plan for providing food upon arrival. Every agency has to provide food from wherever that person came from. So if they're coming from Ethiopia, chances are we're going to Blue Nile to get some food because they provide us with free food. They're so generous. And so we're planning for that arrival. And then when they arrive, we welcome them at the airport, and we take them to wherever they're going to live. After that, we assist them with applying for all of their benefits. Refugees are eligible for Medicaid, cash assistance, and food assistance through Department of Health and Human Services. We help them apply for a Social Security card. We help them apply to enroll in employment services within about the first 2 weeks of arrival. Each refugee receives a minimum of $925. So if you're one person, that's not a lot of money to pay your rent, your utilities, buy some food if you need some furniture or clothing. So we help people maximize that income by receiving donations for items. And then we continue along the process by helping individuals become self-sufficient. I have about 1 minute left. So if you have any questions about this process, I'm happy to stay after and answer. And I'm also happy to come to your organization or your group and talk a little bit more about what happens after refugees get here. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope you learned a lot.
So next we have Miriam Ashraf, who has a little one with her, so she was sitting up front instead. Miriam has served as a foster mother to various unaccompanied minors who have come to the U.S. as refugees, and Milad is with her today, who's recently come here from Afghanistan, and so they're going to share a little bit about their experiences with this process.
Do we have an extra chair up there?
Yeah, we do.
Actually, he's very interested in speaking. He said that he wanted to say something as well.
Okay, but he said first me. So I had actually applied to become a couple of years ago, when we all in America were becoming more and more aware of what was going on with the refugee crisis that was going on globally, and just, you know, living in our comfortable, privileged lives, trying to think about how we could make a difference, one of the things that came up as a potential option for us was to apply to become a foster parent for unaccompanied refugee minors. And we had begun that process through Samaritas. And for some reason, we didn't fulfill all of the requirements for becoming fully fledged foster parents, but some friends of ours who had started the training with us had become foster parents, and they had received notice that they were going to be getting a 16-year-old young woman from Afghanistan who had a brother who had just aged out of the system because he turned 18. And once you turn 18, you're considered an adult, and you're just kind of on your own, and that's that. But they didn't want to separate the two. Okay, go ahead. They didn't want to separate the two of them, so the foster parents who were going to receive the young woman began a kind of a search with Samaritas to see if they could find a quote-unquote host family for the older brother, which we took upon. So we have a very interesting role where we're not quite like foster parents, but we're kind of filling in that role. And we have hosted Milad, and he's become part of our family. And I want to let him introduce himself. And I know he's nervous to do so, but I would, you know, Milad has made amazing, great strides in the past couple of months that he's been here. And I hope that all of you all take a moment to encourage him and just congratulate him on the amount of work that he's done to establish himself and that he continues to do to try and build upon this future for himself, and given the confidence that he needs to know that it's been... He's had a much tougher life than most of us could ever even dream of, and he's doing a fantastic job. So, Milad, I just want to give you a round of applause.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to see you here. My name is Milad Nuri. I'm from Afghanistan. I have been in the United States around 3 months. But I live with Mariam family. And also, I came here with my young sister. She's 16 years old.
Milad, if you let me speak about little bit about your experience. Yes, yes. I don't want to speak on his behalf. I also think that sometimes he's far more humble and doesn't divulge as much information as he could about how truly difficult things have been for him. His father was killed by the Taliban, I believe, early on, right around the time where the United States intervened in Afghanistan as well, around 2003. And after that, his mother was there, and then his mother passed away from illness a couple years later. And when she did, he was kind of on his own. He stayed with some family members who were far, far, far less than generous. I don't want to put words in his mouth or speak on behalf of his experience, but I imagine that they were quite abusive. And I imagine had also put his little sister in quite a bit of danger in terms of potentially selling her off to the highest bidder. So he became the role of primary protector, and he took it upon himself to find ways to keep them safe, and they fled the country. And by a number of, I don't even know how they accomplished it, but challenging means, he made his way from Afghanistan through India to Indonesia, where he was in a camp for a number of years, him and his sister, and they finally found a way to come over here through the process of foster parenting for refugee minors. And that's how he made it here, primarily through his sister, because she became a part of the foster system. And so I think that that's one of the things that we've thought about, is that the foster system is a way where you can really be an asset to the community in a way that, you know, when I thought about becoming a foster parent, to me it was about I'm raising this child with as much privilege as one could possibly be afforded. I have the potential to raise another child and give them those same opportunities. And it's been quite a challenge. It's been quite a challenge just to receive a Social Security card and healthcare benefits and access to education and figuring out where to take English classes and trying to get a job when you don't have any experience, even though him and a number of his friends have a great amount of experience back from their home countries. But it's been, what I've noticed is that something that I can see as a need that arises from potentially the community is how can we be a support system to these communities in things like getting a ride home from work. You know, he's got a bus pass, but sometimes his job will end at 11 p.m. and it's really hard to make it home at 11 p.m. if you have a transfer on your in your bus route. So things like that, or practicing English. I mean, we've gone to Washtenaw County is fantastic in providing resources for ESL classes and whatnot, but even still, just gaining confidence in learning English and just an overall feeling of a sense of support, because coming here is extremely, extremely overwhelming. And from some of his friends as well, I've heard, even though they've had such difficult lives and processes before coming here, it's not as if landing in America has made all of their problems go away. They are quite overwhelmed, and they could use all of the smiles and support that they can get from us. Would you like to say something, Musa, about Milad Pai?
Yeah.
No? Do you like having Milad Pai at home? What do you guys do together? Oh, now he's shy. Do you want to say we play? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So again, I'm happy to answer, both of us, I think, are happy to answer any questions that you have about just our experiences and more so Milad too, just of the process of, it's a lot of paperwork. And that can be daunting. Just filling out paperwork can be daunting. So somebody to provide a helping hand or just a support in doing that as well.
Thank you so much. And our last panelist is Rita Todoran with Washtenaw Refugee Welcome.
Hi, good evening, everybody, and thank you for being here. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you, and please let me know if you can't hear me. You can't hear me at all? How about now? Yeah, this one has moved around a little bit. Is that better? Okay. Okay. So I think the best way to start is to say that I'm here to ask and answer probably the same question that everyone is thinking. What can one person do in the face of the world, the community, the county, the city, the country? What small thing can one person or a group of people do? And the answer is, as several people have said, in Washtenaw County there's plenty going on, and there are some wonderful opportunities to make even the smallest difference and magnify that. So I have been interested in these issues for a very long time, since about 2000. And last year, I recall seeing Pope Francis on television say to all of the churches in Europe, you have to do something. And I remember thinking, why do we live in a world that he should have to say that? Why haven't we thought of that? So I asked my church, which is a very active church in the community, what are we doing? And of course, there were like-minded people who were already concerned about this issue. And long story short, we formed a committee and started looking around for other opportunities and other partners in the community. And that's where, Washtenaw Refugee Welcome comes in. There was a small group, we're still a small group, of people who had the same concerns, the same desire to help, the same desire to reach out, the same issues with presenting something welcoming, positive, and peaceful to take the place of anything angry or hateful. Looking at examples of other countries and communities that didn't take the time to think that through or make that effort, we wanted this to be a place where things worked out well and everyone could share in that assumption, in that assessment of the situation. So we met and we talked and we formed some ideas. Our first partnership, I guess you would say, would be with JFS, our friends at Jewish Family Services, and also at the Samaritas organization. And again, to make a long story short, they took some of our ideas and helped us coalesce those into kind of a mirror structure of the kinds of things that these two resettlement agencies do. And basically what we exist to do is to help these two organizations and other organizations in the community who are actively engaged in the refugee resettlement process in this area. So we tried to replicate in many ways the types of activities, the types of volunteers, the types of committees that both of the resettlement agencies have, as well as adding some of our own efforts to that. We want to be the agency or the organization that other groups turn to when they need one more sofa, one more pair of hands, an extra group of volunteers to make something work, another interpreter, someone who can speak a language that hasn't come up before. We want to do the legwork and the assistance in finding those resources. We have 15 partners now from our little tiny group that started meeting in the spring. We are an ecumenical, wonderful group of people of all faiths, variety of organizations, different ages, individual citizens, community groups, faith groups, congregations, some university students just joining us now. And we are reaching out to say that we are available. Please call on us. Please ask us to help you. We have just received the keys to a storage unit here in Ann Arbor that has walk-in capability, and we are accumulating extra furnishings for people coming here who may need things that aren't readily at hand or who may need just one more of something. We've helped an individual family who had resettled here quite some time ago, a long time ago, but just needed one more mattress, and we were a set of blankets, and we were able to do that. We have a website, which we hope that you will visit, WashtenaRefugeeWelcome.org. We are on the web, and we describe ourselves there. There's an opportunity to volunteer there, an opportunity to donate, and an opportunity to participate in training. We have a training event coming up next Monday in connection with our other partner, Samaritas, and we are making plans for joint training with Jewish Family Services as well. So we have many capabilities. We are trying to be as flexible and quick on our feet as possible, and we're trying to make ourselves well-known in the community so that if you are working on some of these issues and would like support, would like assistance, or would like to join us as we're working, we are open and eager to help everyone. So thank you for letting me introduce this wonderful organization to you. We have two of the co-founders here who've done a fabulous job bringing us all together. Every day we get emails and phone calls from people who have heard about us and want to join in this effort, which once again just underscores what a great community this is and what great people are out here. So when people say that things have changed, that there are so many bad people out there, you just have to look a little harder, because there are many, many good people excuse me, who are right here. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So now we have roughly 30 minutes to take questions. So a microphone has been set up in the center aisle. If you just want to stand up, if you want to direct your question towards a specific panelist, that's fine. Otherwise, we'll sort of divvy them up amongst who we have here. Here we go.
Hi, thank you for the great work you're doing. And I was very intrigued by the various possibilities that you all offer. Probably like everyone else, I became incensed when I saw the little boy in Aleppo in the back of an ambulance trying to figure out what to do with the blood that was covering his head. What's happening to orphans is part of my question. And the other question I had, and this was sort of an idea that came to me as a result of witnessing a special on PBS about a Jewish family in Philadelphia who helped orphans come to this country during World War II because they opened a camp. And apparently the rules are different in terms of bringing children in if you have a camp. And I wondered if anybody had talked about that possibility here. It would take quite an effort, I realize, of volunteers. But perhaps that could get us around some of the red tape required to bring in, especially orphans. Thank you.
Miriam, did you want to talk at all about unaccompanied minors, maybe? Some of that process, or...?
I don't have any information that would be able to answer your specific question about the a camp type situation that would potentially make it easier to have unaccompanied minors come over. And I know that much of the process must already be done by the time the unaccompanied minors get over here, because Shrina was saying, they've gone through quite a lengthy security process, and I have no idea what goes on the other side. And all I know is that the process that happens when they come here is usually facilitated by organizations. I think Samaritas is the only organization that deals with unaccompanied minors for our area. Which is a little bit difficult for us because Jewish Family Services is actually the primary organization that works within the Washtenaw County area, and Samaritas is not as present in Washtenaw County, although I know that they're trying to become and create more of a presence. I don't have a specific answer to how we would be able to make it easier. All I do know is that there are many, many, many orphans out there who are struggling. Extremely struggling. So, it's just a matter of you're right. I'm in the same boat as you, is how do we make these connections to try and build bridges and make it an easier process? And I don't know the answer to your specific question. I'm sorry.
If I could just make a comment, I don't believe there is any process where you can sort of start a camp situation. I think all minors have to go through the unaccompanied refugee minor program that ensures that all minors are eligible for services through the Department of Health and Human Services.
I also want to thank you for being here and for this program. I'm curious to know what our local mosque is doing. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm kind of surprised that they're not represented here.
Yeah. Well, I'm here. I'm not part of the mosque at all, but they informed me that they were not able to be here tonight. And I'm sure other people can say all kinds of things, but WRW, as we call ourselves, Washtenaw Refugee Welcome, is working.
Can't hear you.
Gosh. Closer to me, huh?
There you go.
Better?
Yep.
Okay. I think we've been playing too much up here. I cannot speak for the mosque, but I must just simply say that our partners there were not able to attend tonight. But we are working very closely with the Ann Arbor community, with Muslim Social Services, and with individual families to assist them. And they are volunteering with us, and we are joining programs and supporting ongoing efforts and dreaming up new ones. And, for example, we will share a storage and walk-in facility very shortly on Plymouth Road in Ann Arbor.
In Ann Arbor?
In Ann Arbor.
The Muslim community is active in Ann Arbor?
Yes, very much so.
Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. And I can speak a little bit to how they assist us. The Islamic Center, specifically on Plymouth Road and the other mosques in the area, when we need assistance, we are able to call them, and they do answer our calls. So they primarily assist us with financial assistance. So if we have a family who needs money for food or to pay a couple of bills here and there, they are able to assist us with that. Also, they frequently, refugees have to stay in a hotel for a night or two, depending on when they arrive and when their apartment is going to be ready. A lot of refugees arrive in the middle of the night, and we aren't able to move them into their apartments that night due to us not being able to sign the lease till the next day. And so the local mosques, we call them, and they actually provide meals to our families. So they will come and deliver meals. If a client family has to stay in a hotel for 1-2 days, then they will actually come provide socialization support as well as meals all throughout their stay. So they're very active in the resettlement process.
They should be here.
Unfortunately, they weren't able to be here. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
They work on so many things.
I am not a representative of the Ann Arbor Mosque community. However, I am, a Muslim participant in the community, and I attend the mosque. My son actually goes to school at the Islamic school at the mosque, and I think that the ways in which the Muslim community participates is often in a far less organized manner, so there may not be an actual organization that you can seek out a website for, finding the bullet point services that they are offering. But what it more often is like a volunteer pairing up of communities. So when a Syrian family comes, other Syrian families within the mosque community will kind of take it upon themselves to welcome them into the community, give them a chance to befriend their children, invite them over for dinner, and provide a less structured support service for them. So even though there's not a website that you're going to go to that will say, we provide this, this, and this, but oftentimes it's a matter of the community members speaking amongst themselves about the needs of the refugees and being able to provide both material goods or kitchen goods, furniture, other things that they may need, and also a community of support.
And I would also like to add that post 9/11, the world became probably a very scary place for Arabs and Muslims. I can, speak from personal experience. My husband is Arab, and for him to go into places is pretty scary. For him to go to the airport, he travels very frequently, is very scary. So I think for them to open themselves up to be in front of a room of people who may or may not be supportive of them could possibly be very scary. And I'm not going to speak on their behalf, but I can imagine that that's sometimes, individuals' perceptions. Can they trust the people that they are in front of? So we have to take a look at a place of empathy and understanding, and also think about what that experience must be like. Speaking as an Indian American, there are certain situations, just by the way I look, I have darker skin, I have dark hair. There are certain situations for myself that can be very scary. And I think that's a part of being a community, to show people that you don't have to fear us. We're here to support you. We can all work together. Like I said, they're very active. They're very active in the process, and that's what this is all about, right? Like we want to show people that we're not to be feared, right?
And again, I can attest to that. I know ladies who are in a basement this very moment, sorting clothes, packing them up, getting them ready. They're very, very busy in that community. And the other thing that they do that we are hoping to have been and hoping to continue to help with is that these are community members, and they know each other for a long time, well after the resettlement process has, quote-unquote, ended. And as I say, sometimes people who have been here for quite a while kind of resurface or move to the area, and we have already had calls for, as I said, just one more piece of bedding or blanketing or whatever. People are looking out for one another. So please don't read anything into a representative not being here or a website not existing. We're already all working together.
Hi there. Hi. Can someone speak to, for fostering unaccompanied minors, what are some of the qualifications or criteria that they look for? Not the entire process, but maybe like a summary of who, what kind of candidates they're looking for. And then I also have a direct question for Milad, if he's open to it. Could you share a positive experience, something good that has happened for you since you've been in Washtenaw County?
So what was something that was good that happened while you were here in Washtenaw County?
I am happy to lead it. Mariam.
Yeah, I'm very happy to with family, with my host family. I have a good relationship with them. I love my little brother.
I think they all do.
Yeah, I'm happy. Thank you.
Is there an organization for fostering?
Yes. So Samaritas is another resettlement agency in Michigan who has recently been approved to also resettle in Washtenaw County. Not accompanied minors, but just families, refugee families, but has been resettling unaccompanied minors in Washtenaw County also for some time. So if you want more information, I think their unaccompanied minor office is based out of Lansing. So we can get you the contact information for Kyla Park and others who work in that office.
To give you a little bit of a background into the process for becoming a foster parent for an unaccompanied refugee minor is the same as to become a foster parent to domestic children. So it is, you can apply through a number of different organizations. I applied through Samaritas because currently they're the only ones that do the refugee minor resettlement. And the beginning, you start with a simple application that discusses the number of people who live in your home. They have income requirements that you don't have to be a very wealthy person to foster, but you do have to show proof of income, proof of insurance. They have a little bit of space requirements. You know, they want to know, they want to ensure that the children that are going to be entering your home have appropriate accommodations, a bedroom or potentially a shared bedroom if it's large enough. They will come to your home and do site visits. They will just tour your home, make sure that your home is safe. You go through a number of different safety trainings, and you go through a number of different orientations for the what you would expect as a foster parent. And then after that, there is a caseworker assigned to your case. Usually for the minors, there's one caseworker for the child and one caseworker for you as the parents or the family, and everybody works together. The foster child is allotted X amount of, or the family is allotted X amount of a dollar amount, and then has been given a little bit of a stipend to spend on the care of the child, and then they have regulations and rules based on, you know, how often, if the children are allowed to be left alone, they cannot be left alone for more than X number of time, making sure that their needs are met, they're being taken to doctor's appointments, whatnot. The process takes usually about a couple of months, and then after that, you're fully licensed, it can take another couple of months to receive a placement for a child. But there is always a lack of people who are already licensed to be foster parents. And so I know that that's always something that they suggest, whether it's for domestic children, because there is quite a large need there as well. And we discussed, my family discussed that about, you know, we don't need to be looking outside in an international realm to find children who need a home and a stable home. But it's a little bit different because fostering within the domestic system, the ultimate goal is for them to be back with their family, but for refugee minors, that is not the same goal, obviously, because they're not going back to their family.
Hi. I'm really glad you spoke to your experience as a refugee going to different having to go to different countries. I was in India for several years, and I worked with refugees for a while when I was there through nonprofits. And what a lot of people don't know is that the majority of refugees in the world don't come to the US or different countries in Europe. The majority of refugees end up going to neighboring countries, mostly in the developing world, where you know the process to get in is not as challenging, but the resources are also much more limited than they would be in the US or Canada or Europe. So what refugees go through in these countries, in terms of trying to rebuild their lives, they have a lot more limited resources than they would get here. But getting back to the presentation you made about hate crimes, you know, I've worked with projects out of Wayne State and in other counties and on hate crimes against South Asians, and they have been on a huge increase since 9/11 because of the perception by a lot of Americans that, you know, kind of we're all the same. I've even heard it at work when I've worked here at the university by administrators. Oh, you're all the same, you know, because we all, quote unquote, look alike, you know? And actually, a lot of hate crimes that were committed post 9/11 were committed against South Asians who weren't Muslim, but because of the perception that a lot of people had. And these hate crimes that have been, you know, perpetuated have been because of that perception. It's not just because they know we're South Asian and we're different from mainstream America, but that rather that we're all alike kind of thing. I was wondering if you had looked into that in terms of broadening your base for, I guess, community support and community bolstering from different communities in terms of spreading your message of awareness of hate crimes and awareness of and community building.
If I can speak to that for a moment. So the One Human Family campaign, One Human Family is a very broad message and it's meant to include everybody. We ran the risk of becoming sort of a hashtag all lives matter type situation and making sure that we want to lift up the specific people, hashtag, you know, Black Lives Matter, making sure that we're really being specific about giving faces and names to the populations who are in need. And obviously that extends far beyond Muslims and refugees. And so that's a continued conversation. And that's where it's so great that we have these organizations in Washtenaw County, like the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice and Interfaith Roundtable. And so that's, I mean, a fantastic point and a fantastic issue that needs to be addressed. And so I encourage you to get involved in these organizations so that we can lift up those stories further.
So thank you so much for this wonderful panel. I sit on the Interfaith Roundtable of Washtenaw County, and I was really inspired last year by some of the programs that we had. One was also on immigration. And just to further discussion in the community, I'm facilitating three different salons at Crazy Wisdom Bookstore. The first one starting tomorrow night called Building Bridges Between People, Dispelling Fear and Creating Hope. And the one tomorrow night starting at 7 is on From Separation to Community, Building Bridges Through Nonviolent Communication. And we're going to be doing some work together to understand how we can improve our communication so that our language doesn't trigger, we don't trigger each other through our language. And then on the 6th, on October 6th, on Thursday night, there's going to be a salon called Creating an Interfaith Dialogue for Deep Listening. And we are having an imam from the Metro Detroit area sitting on that panel along with a rabbi and somebody from Reverend Greg Briggs, who is representing the One Human Family campaign. And then on the 20th of October, there's going to be a salon called Immigration, Dispelling Fear of the Other in This Age of Terrorism. And I know Sharina is going to be on that. And we have the outreach chair of the Muslim community in Ann Arbor coming to speak there, someone from Samaritas, and an attorney from the Immigration Rights Agency in Washtenaw County. So if you are interested in just continuing the discussion, this is an open discussion for the whole community because these issues are so critical that I'm so happy that I found that this was happening tonight because I think we can all benefit from working together on all these issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry, your name was?
Lucinda Kurtz.
All right, find Lucinda for more information.
Okay, I put some brochures back there, but Thursday night at Crazy Wisdom starting at 7 o'clock. Free and open to the public.
Oh, yeah, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I have a quick question. So I know with, and correct me if I'm wrong with this information, but I know with some of the Syrian refugees coming, hopefully coming from Europe in the next coming months, that in order to be designated an asylum site, that there are specific parameters set forth by the government, that you have to have like a participating health system, you have to have a participating resettlement program. Is that true or like a resettlement?
Sharina, do you wanna?
Not exactly sure.
I know that there's a site in like Chicago and there's a site in Columbus, and I know there's a site in Indiana, but I was just wondering if you could speak to that.
I really can't. I'm very sorry.
Okay.
Are you speaking specifically about Syrians then, or?
Yeah, specific to that particular population.
As far as I know, Syrians are coming to Michigan.
Yeah.
So. I think we're set. I think that Washtenaw County has everything our checklist. So, okay. Great. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Akad Mehra. I'm originally from India. I moved to the U.S. about 3 years ago for my master's here. I have a question, but before that, I actually want to talk to Malad. This is something I learned in the U.S., and I'm going to come there and do this to you. My question is to Sharina about the refugees who come here and once they're settled, about you said there's a lot of paperwork involved. After that, are there still more checks after that, that the DHS or someone after every year comes back and says that, hey, is that guy still there?
Yeah, so great question. Every refugee that comes has to report to the Department of State wherever they're living. So when they initially come, it's a simple form called an AR-11. So that's how they let the Department of State know where they are. But after that, there's really, unless they're moving somewhere, there is no checks. I mean, like, the FBI is not knocking on our door saying, is this person still here? So after that, that's it. Every refugee is required to apply for a green card, though. So after 1 year, they're eligible to receive permanent status here in the United States. So aside from moving, that's the only way that people know where they are.
Well, they do get Michigan identification cards.
Of course. Yeah. Yep, Michigan IDs, driver's license. They're eligible to work upon arrival, so they all get employment authorization cards. It's actually stamped on their visas. So they're able to come here and have every opportunity to become self-sufficient, and there are programs set up to assist them.
What kind of numbers are these programs involved? Are they 20, 100, 5,000?
By programs, what do you mean?
What we've been
resettlement.
Resettlement.
There are about, and I actually have numbers here, about 180 communities that resettle refugees across the country. Okay. So about 350 affiliates. In Michigan, there's about... Four No, four.
But the number of refugees.
Sorry. Oh, number of refugees coming to the United or here in Michigan. Well, okay. So at JFS. So yeah, Washtenaw County. We resettled 100 this last fiscal year. We resettled 165 individuals. Thank you. Next fiscal year will be 300. Samaritas has been approved to resettle 100 more refugees. So 400 new community members will be joining us next fiscal year. And I imagine it's going to be above that because we are allowed to go 10% above our numbers. So we were originally contracted for 150 individuals. And I imagine it'll be above that. For next fiscal year, the presidential determination is 110,000. And I would just like to add, the presidential determination was 85,000 for this year, and we have met that, and we were about to exceed that. So that's it's really, really fantastic that we have been able to do that. All of the 180 communities that have been participating. So,
Just a comment and then a question. Compared to Jordan, to the surrounding countries, we're taking nothing in terms of the numbers, really. But my question is, I've gone on to the JFS website to see about volunteering. Mm-hmm. There are several pages that have to be filled out to do that. What is the process for being accepted as a volunteer, and can you talk about the different possibilities?
Sure. So I'm really glad you asked that. JFS has a welcome wagon program in which you can come to a 90-minute training. And yes, that's a really long time. But at JFS, we really value our clients' confidentiality. We really value that our anybody who volunteers with us is thoroughly trained. So it is a 90-minute training. And then you are able to choose about 15 different roles that you would like to volunteer in. So that could be anywhere from day of helping, you know, us move a family into their apartment to purchasing, you know, going and purchasing food for them, to working in our office with us. As you can imagine, there's a lot of paperwork that needs to be filled out, but that paperwork needs to be printed out. We need help sorting donations and accepting donations and, you know, organizing our furniture warehouse. So we do have that program available. So I encourage you to go on the website to fill out the application, and then we will call you back for a volunteer training. You can also volunteer through WRW, which is a network of organizations, and they will also be providing similar types of services to us as well.
Thank you to everyone on the panel, and I am so happy to hear of the organized efforts to resettle all of the refugees who come, and of the ones from Syria who are coming, as I understand it, pretty soon to Washtenaw County. And they're already here? They're all already here? Okay.
They're already. Actually, the majority of our arrivals were Syrians this year.
Okay.
Syrians and Iraqis.
Okay. It just was interesting to me. I also work with Laura in Wicker for immigration, and the not all, but the vast majority of the people who come to us as immigrants are from the Latino community. They're from south of the border. And so many of the things that we can welcome people who have refugee status with are not afforded to those people. At this point in time, people who are coming, and many of them are fleeing also from violence, especially in Central America, especially in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And there's a lot of reasons for the violence there that we could talk about another time. But they cannot get driver's licenses here. They don't have an agency to help resettle themselves. And many of the, or to find furniture and all of those kinds of things. And it's just important to remember that. I would just like us to remember that, too, that there are people who come that are actually refugees. I wish we could call them refugees because they are either economic or refugees from violence. And I think it's just important to raise that up. Thank you.
I'd like to make a comment about that. Thank you, Marianne. One very simple thing you can do is go to the county and get your Washtenaw County ID. Okay, the Washtenaw County ID project was we worked with Synod and many, many other folks in the community to develop a Washtenaw County resident ID, photo ID. And this was for anyone who does not have a photo identification. Imagine not being able to present a photo identification to a police officer, to a doctor, to any place where you are asked for your driver's license. Undocumented immigrant folks have not been able to get a state ID or a driver's license for about 5 years now, since they linked the Social Security number with the driver's license. Okay, so we are the only county, we're very proud of this, we're the only county in probably the nation. There are cities that have done it, there are other municipalities that have done it, very few, but we as a county now have a Washtenaw County photo identification. I have one in my wallet if you'd like to see it. And what our project is right now is that we want as many documented mainstream Ann Arbor and Washtenaw County residents to get it and use it so that it becomes a normal identification and that people who are using it are not suspect. You know, it was not developed just for immigrants, but there's a lot of elder Jim Crow era African American people who do not have photo IDs. There's a lot of homeless folks that don't have photo IDs. There's just a lot of people that are under-identified in our residents, and this is why this ID was created. So one thing you can do is go get it and then use it everywhere. So anytime I'm asked for a driver's license, I bring out my Washtenaw County ID, and they're like, "What's this?" I'm like, "Oh, you don't know about the Washtenaw County ID? Oh, well, let me tell you about it." Yeah. So that is something very simple that you can do to really start to bring that project that is such an amazing feat. We had to go through the commission. Okay, so you go right down to the county building on Main, right? Main Street, yeah. And you go in there to Vital Records. It's $25, and there are criteria, you have to show certain, but we worked very hard to make it an ID that was secure, but there were many options. So you have to show proof in a number of categories, eligibility proof in a number of categories, and they can tell you, or you can go online and find out what those are. You have to show a birth certificate or other documents, and you've got to show a proof of residence, so like a bill, you know, a utility bill or whatever. So they have certain criterion, and then you can get it right there. And it's really kind of a cute card. It's really groovy. But I just want to say too is that you can make a donation of $25 to let somebody else get a card, to pay for someone else's card as well. And I just want to say, and I just also, I put out a fact sheet for Wicker out in the back out there, and also the flyer for our urgent responder training that's coming up October 8th if you're interested.
Okay. All right, we're going to take one last question and then wrap it up because we have someone who's been waiting to speak. Yeah.
I have a question about getting, if any of your organizations work with elementary schools or schools in general in Ann Arbor public area. My son's teacher has asked if I could find out information to get his school involved.
We work with the schools all the time, and we frequently have teachers come to us asking how their classes can get involved. So I'd be happy to give you my card so that we can stay in contact and discuss what those opportunities could be. Okay.
We also cross over with the schools. We mostly work with schools when we get calls from teachers or social workers that are really concerned about the symptoms of children that are being affected by their parents or their neighbors and their other family members being detained and deported. So we've gone and done presentations in schools, but we mostly get involved based on case by case experiences where teachers and other school personnel are noticing the devastating effects of increased immigration enforcement on the children.
Yeah. I think schools are going to get continuously involved. We've noticed an uptick in the number of teachers applying to be volunteers as well.
Thank you so much to everybody. This was fabulous. On behalf of the One Human Family Campaign, Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice, Interfaith Roundtable, I want to thank everybody who came, all of our panelists, every house of worship that's put up a sign, every family that's put up a sign, everyone who's shared things on Facebook. Just really, again, the support has been amazing.